Coming up on today's program.
All the communication on the phones and the tablets and the mail, it's all monitored. However, there's such a huge volume of communication going on that it's difficult for prison officials to keep up.
A massive influx of drugs going into Ohio's prison system. I'm Jerry Kenny. This is WISA Weekend. As always, thanks for sharing your weekend with WISO. We'll talk with Laura Bischoff, one of the reporters for that series released by the Columbus Dispatch this past week. Up first, the Greater Dayton LGBT Center is celebrating its 50th year. The nonprofit organizes the annual Pride celebration, but it also focuses on advocacy and outreach. On a recent visit to the center's North St. Clair location, I met with Executive Director Rick Flynn.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm good.
The center has been at this location for about 2 years, and Flynn says it's still very much a work in progress.
Our lobby, which I really like, it feels like we were working with a lot of unfinished spaces, and we did this, and I just wanted one room to look done. And so we painted it and did the floor and everything, and it looks more done now. There's still things it needs, but I'm happy.
In short order, we make our way through the building's first floor and settle at a small kitchen table in Flynn's office to talk about the center's history and their current role in the community.
The fact that we're sitting at a kitchen table is kind of indicative of how I feel we are in the community. We're that kitchen table where you can come in and sit down and chat and make connections. And I hope we always are that. I would hate to see us get so big that we lose that personal touch. We've got a lot of volunteers out there who are advocating for the center, advocating for our mission, and jumping in and helping whenever they can. Pride is mostly made up of volunteers. I do some of the legwork, but it's the volunteers who put it all together. They make it happen. And I think that's important, that it is community driven. And it's nice being downtown, sort of in the midst of everything going on. This building became available at just the right time that we were looking, and so we jumped on it. Now, with that being said, old buildings bring issues, so we deal with those as they come up and as much as we can. But we're happy with our spot, and I think it's got a lot of possibility. I always semi-apologize when people come in and just say, you know, we're a work in progress. So it's not a finished product. And I think that's important, too, because I think that's all of us. We're all a work in progress. And, you know, once it's done, then what?
Well, and then, of course, the main point is the mission and the outreach. So tell me a little bit about how those efforts are done.
Outreach is interesting because I think it can be anything from tabling at a resource fair to having a conversation with somebody who just calls looking for answers. And the way we do it is just try to be authentic about it. A lot of times I'll get a phone call and I don't know the answers. Like I'm going to Google just as much as they are, but I think just hearing somebody at the other end of the phone who's listening, that makes a big difference. So what you see visually, yes, that's great, but there's a lot of stuff behind the scenes that happens. So I think outreach could probably be better. I would love to do more, but we're limited. We're limited on what we can do with the organization that we have. Someday when we have a staff of 25 or something.
That's a challenge really for any organization. You mentioned putting together a survey. Any other challenging things that the center needs to overcome or special events that you've got coming up?
Well, there are always going to be challenges. A few weeks ago, the furnace went out, and so that became a big challenge and getting that taken care of. And there's, you know, the roof and all the challenges that come with the building. Politically, I think we see a lot of challenges because we just don't know what's next. There's a lot of speculation, and we can all get sucked up into that. But I think that, you know, we got to keep our eye on the ball and just keep moving forward. As far as events, we've got a few things planned. You're actually going to be the first to hear this. We're doing a birthday party for ourselves on April 19th. So it's going to be from noon to 3. Just invite people in. We'll have cake or cupcakes or something like that. Tell stories and just kind of hang out. So we're doing that. We've got a film coming up with the Neon in collaboration for our 50th. We're going to do Paris is Burning. It seemed like a nice historical piece to kind of go with everything. We're doing an art exhibit with Dayton Society of Artists. That will be April 4th. We're doing a reception for that. We've got Pride coming up, and that takes up all the brain matter at the moment.
What are the dates for Pride this year?
They are Friday, June 5th and Saturday, June 6th.
And people can get more information about your organization and all the events coming up.
Yes, go to our website, www.DaytonLGBTCenter.org, or follow us on Facebook or Instagram.
Rick Flynn, thanks so much.
Thank you.
This week, the Ohio Newsroom reported on the Commodity Supplemental Food Program, a federal initiative that provides low-income seniors with a monthly box of pantry staples like cereal and canned veggies. Around 30,000 seniors in Ohio are eligible for the aid, but some can't get their boxes because they don't have transportation. The Ohio Newsroom's Aaron Gottsacker reports a proposed bipartisan bill in Congress could help.
On the second Friday of every month, a steady stream of DoorDash drivers line up outside the Shared Harvest Food Bank in Butler County, just north of Cincinnati. Instead of delivering restaurant meals, today, these drivers are handing out senior food boxes.
So you have 10 deliveries today?
Coordinator Lily Austin gives them the lowdown while volunteers squeeze boxes into back seats.
Each individual person, they will receive one of these big brown 40-pound boxes, and then each individual person will get one of these blocks of cheese.
Okay.
Shared Harvest Food Bank started distributing food this way during COVID, and the practice has stuck around. They still deliver nearly 500 boxes of food to homebound seniors each month. Robert Zofeld is the food bank's director of programs. As Ohio's population ages, he says the need for doorstep delivery is high.
In Butler County specifically, we get people who don't have transportation, they have medical issues.
But their current program has a limited reach.
Where the DoorDashers specifically pick up, they can deliver 10 miles as a crow flies.
Given this is the only pickup location in the 5-county service area, that leaves around 2,000 square miles without a delivery option. A proposed piece of legislation could help. The Delivering for Rural Seniors Act, co-sponsored by Ohio Republican Senator John Husted, would create a 3-year pilot program to fund food delivery to underserved populations, like seniors with disabilities or those without reliable access to transportation. Food banks across the state support the idea. Like Shared Harvest in Butler County, the Second Harvest Food Bank of North Central Ohio has also been experimenting with ways to deliver senior food boxes to the elderly. Instead of using DoorDash, it relies on a fleet of 80 volunteers to distribute the boxes. Erin Moore-Ondich heads the program. She sees the impact of direct delivery firsthand.
A lot of my seniors tell me, you know, like, maybe they do have a vehicle, right? But they have to choose between, am I going to fill up my car with gas or to get my medicine and go to the doctor or to wait in a food line for a long time?
Others care for their grandchildren, so they have to be at home during the day. Rosalie Martin, a former social worker, says she deals with painful arthritis.
Some days you just don't move too well. So having them deliver it is fantastic because I don't have any family here. They're all in the west side of Cleveland, so I'm pretty much on my own out here.
With additional funding, Moore-Ondich says Second Harvest Food Bank could help more people like Martin. And there's a lot of people interested in the help. As inflation and the cost of living continue to rise, seniors living on fixed incomes can only stretch their budgets so far.
There's definitely a huge need. I do have a wait list, and I have calls coming in every day. I'm doing applications almost every day.
For now, the Delivering for Rural Seniors Act has been referred to the Senate Committee on Agriculture, Nutrition, and Forestry. In Butler County, I'm Erin Gottsacker.
You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Let's get to that series of reports from the Columbus Dispatch about the amount of drugs flowing into Ohio's prison system, often through the use of drones. The reporting comes from the Marshall Project Cleveland and USA Today Bureau reporter for Ohio, Laura Bischoff. I spoke with Bischoff about the year-long reporting effort.
The data showed that shift officers since 2020 have logged in 56,000 suspected drug seizures. And in most cases on the spot, they don't know where it came from, like in less than 5% of the time. And it's really unclear through the investigative process if they nail it down for, you know, a higher percentage of where these drugs are coming from. And one of the things that's going on in Ohio and in other prison and jail systems across the country is what they call K2 or TUNE. It's chemicals, synthetic cannabinoids that are sprayed onto paper and then smuggled in. Now, these are hard to detect. The drug dogs can't necessarily sniff out the compounds. They're very easy to smuggle, and they're also easy to hide. One sheet of copier paper, 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, is worth maybe $6,000 inside if it's been soaked with drugs. And each piece of paper is cut into postage stamp size pieces, and then that postage stamp is then further cut down. So there's about 1,500 hits on a single piece of paper. So one sheet of paper, $6,000. Imagine if you're smuggling in a couple of sheets of paper, either through drone drops or you're walking it right through the front door. It's incredibly lucrative.
Laura, the articles and short documentaries that accompany them on the Columbus Dispatch website are pretty eye-opening. What are officials saying about all this?
Well, the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Correction notes that it's taken a lot of steps to try to address this problem. Like I said, a lot of the drugs are coming through as soaked in on paper, and they were seeing a lot of it come in through the mail or disguised as legal correspondence between an incarcerated person and their attorney. And so the state opened up a mail processing center, and they process about 158,000 pieces of mail each year. And they scan all of that and they deliver it to the incarcerated people via their tablets. They have tablets in prison for emails, text messages, listening to music, things like that, video visits. So they opened this mail center, and that's going to hopefully shut down a massive pipeline. They added drone detection technology to most of the prisons, although they won't say which ones or how good the technology is. There's some limitations to that because there's FAA rules. And then they've added like these really tall fencing to some of the prisons. It almost looks like a Top Golf facility. The fences are that high. And so, you know, DRC has taken a number of steps, but still, this is a massive problem. And there's so much money to be made that they're really kind of up against it.
It seems that if prisoners have things like tablets, there is a certain amount of freedom and autonomy to kind of help facilitate this problem?
Yes and no. I mean, all the communication on the phones and the tablets and the mail, it's all monitored. However, there's such a huge volume of communication going on that it's difficult for prison officials to keep up. And I would say also incarcerated people who are dealing drugs, they're going to speak in code. And as soon as the investigators catch on to the code, the people, you know, change the code words about what they're talking about. Ohio DRC has added AI just recently to monitor a lot of this communication, and we'll see if it's successful if they expand that. So there's, you know, they could get caught if they're doing it on the monitored stuff. One of the other big problems is these smugglers are bringing in cell phones, and the cell phones are not monitored, and so they're able to conduct business without being detected.
I think many who read the articles and watch the short films will be surprised by what's happening. But any surprises from your perspective as a reporter and what you've learned over the last year?
You know, the patrol does the investigations on all crimes on state properties. And in 2023 and 2024, prosecutors charged 20 state employees for collectively smuggling like 5 pounds of tobacco, 2 pounds of marijuana, half a pound of meth, half an ounce of cocaine, 1,900 strips of Suboxone, 619 pieces of drug-soaked paper, including 218 full pages. Now, I said like that full page is worth, on average, about $6,000. And so just those 218 full pages are valued between $1 million and $4 million. And to me, that's pretty surprising, like how much money there is to be made in this black market.
Laura Bischoff is Bureau reporter for USA Today Network, Ohio Bureau. based with the Columbus Dispatch. Thanks so much for your time today, and great job with the articles available on the Columbus Dispatch website.
Thanks, Jerry.
Up next on WYSO, we've got a little music and conversation. This was recorded in a recent studio session, which you can find under the Music tab on the WYSO homepage. Evan Miller, Midday Music host, spoke with Vermont-based artist Lily Seaburg, who recently hit the road with her band for a month-long tour. Here's part of that conversation.
What makes you happy? What makes you go?
Lily Seaburg here on Midday Music. That one and the first one from Trash Mountain out last year.
Yes.
Tell me about what is Trash Mountain? Like the what is not the record, but like what is Trash Mountain?
Trash Mountain is like low key like the name sort of sometimes sort of like this like hippie co-op that I lived at.
Okay.
In Burlington. Like, it's just, like, the place that people have lived. And I just called the record Trash Mountain because I wrote the songs at Trash Mountain and I talk about Trash Mountain. But now it's, like, everyone's always like, what is Trash Mountain? I was like, you know when, like, you go to, like, a house show and it's, like, called, the Rat Hole or, like, something? Like, people just, the Rat Hole is a place in Frederick, Maryland.
Yeah, there used to be one in Columbus, like, the Fortress of Doom, or it's not
like
quite that.
Like
I botched the name, I think, but
Trash Mountain, like, I think comes from the fact that like behind it was like a dump like 60 years ago. It's not a landfill, it was just like a dump. But a lot of Burlington actually is built on top of trash. I think like Main Street, isn't it like trash under Main Street? That's where they're doing all the construction, right? Because it's like caving into the trash, and then like that whole edge of town where Trash Mountain was is like along this street called Riverside. That is, Rick has been in another band for a long time called the Worm Dogs. And what's the song called? Riverside? It's like, I got lost on Riverside, and it's like about the, is it called Riverside? Yeah. And like that song is also about how it's like this part of town is about to like fall off into the trash hole. Basically, like, it's like eroding, and it's like a big issue because like no one's doing anything about it, but like it's eroding really fast, and there's like houses and stuff and like roads.
Why is it built on trash?
Do you know?
That's just what they did back in
the day. That's just what they did. I don't know, and it's just what they did.
But yeah,
it's just what they were doing.
Yeah, the farms in Burlington are like kind of on these lowlands, and it turns out that's a now like a huge flood sort of plain, and as of the past couple of years, so it's eroding. All the trash that the town is kind of built on is being uncovered, and all these like weird old car parts and sand are kind of coming out.
Yeah, from like climate change, basically. You know, I used to work for an environmental nonprofit and called one of the PIRGs, if you know about like public interest research groups, but I worked for VPIRG for a long time. But VPIRG is actually separate from the US PIRG. But anyways, climate, Burlington is one of the fastest changing from climate change like places in America, actually. I think like the stat is like the winters and summers are like warmer by like 7 degrees in like the last 10
years.
Wow. Yeah. So the trash is also being uncovered. So
at an alarming rate, it's
yeah. So I mean, that's like, yeah, that's the Trash Mountain story. I feel like people keeping like, there was like so many like little articles like when the record came out that were like, Trash Mountain, it's like this bohemia of artists. I was like, it's really not.
It's like a punk house.
No, it's just like a house where people live, and it is in a little bit of disarray. It's not like a punk house though, but it's definitely like snakes in the walls and rats. And I don't live there now, but my friends live there still.
Are there still snakes and rats in there?
Probably, yes, there are. I feel bad. I'm putting everyone on blast, but
it sounds like they have trash to deal with.
Yeah, but it's not our fault. Yeah. It's like the whole area.
Yeah, another generation's fault, and now
I think
the
house will
be
demolished eventually. Soon, the foundation is cracked.
Well, thank you all so much for taking some time out of in between shows today to stop by and have a little fun. This has been really great. I really appreciate y'all being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And you can hear more music from Lily Seabird and lots more conversation on the WYSO website. Just check out the latest studio session. This week was International Transgender Day of Visibility. WYSO's Lee Wade, creator and host of Translucent, has one trans woman's story of coming out.
Hi, I'm Lee Wade, and you're listening to Translucent, a series that amplifies trans voices, humanizes our community, and creates space for the real everyday conversations that don't make headlines. On today's episode of Translucent, we meet Iden Crockett, a trans woman who came out in her early 40s while married, raising kids, and working as a firefighter. Iden remembers the moment she came out to her family and says she faced it head on.
I approached all of my comings out just sort of that ripping the Band-Aid off. My family was out of town. I thought, well, I will wait until they get back, and then I will talk about this with my wife. That didn't work. We were on the phone that night, and I just said, hey, I wore girls' clothes all day long today. And she was like, oh, okay. And I said, I really liked it, and I'm going to do it forever. And I'm a woman now. So that was how I handled that. And we were a little bit more tactful with the kids, although we probably didn't need to be. I'm convinced that they, even as young as they were at the time, knew more about transgender people than me. They really seemed to accept things right off the bat. I was nervous, but I wasn't as afraid as I should have been. I think that I had coasted through life a little bit in that when I was presenting male, I was popular. I was a good-looking guy. I had never really been an outcast. I'd never really had to deal with any sort of discrimination or bad treatment. And I went into this very naively thinking, well, maybe some people will have problems with it, or maybe they would have problems with other people, but I'm Iden, and I'm so cool that this, I'm going to be the one who goes through this, and it's not going to be an issue. And so I didn't really have time to be afraid until I was already in it, you know? And so no, there was no moment until well beyond it being too late for me to be afraid.
At a time when pushback makes people hesitant to come out, Iden says there's real power in being visible.
I talk to a lot of trans people that sort of go back and forth. Do I come out? Do I transition? Or do I stay hiding and feel safe? And I what I hope is that they find the courage to commit to it also and come out. Because the other half of this is I hope that the cisgendered people see the joy and the power of being yourself. You don't have to be trans to be hiding who you are. Everybody I know is hiding aspects of themselves and carry the shame, whether that's shame for their past or some of their current problems or their mistakes or just, you know, their body isn't how they want or their job isn't what they carry all of these things, and they don't have to. And so I hope that people see that it's possible to be yourself and that it is powerful to be yourself. And when they see somebody out there living as who they really are, regardless of whether they're trans, and instead of punishing it and fearing it, they respect it and admire it.
What has your kids taught you about courage and like vulnerability as Iden?
Well, I will say that what my kids have taught me is that at the end of the day, as complicated as it seems to be trans, it isn't. It's very simple. It's very simple to call someone what they want to be called. It's very simple to use the pronouns that they want to use and treat them how they are asking to be treated. When I sat down and told the kids that I was trans and that, you know, my name was Iden now and I wanted to use she, her, and all of this, they said, okay. And then they did. And I watch them now that they're older, they're teenagers and they're going through this and, you know, they have genderqueer friends and all of this. And that is what they do with their friends. That is what they do with other adult trans people in their lives. It is very simple and easy to respect somebody.
That was Aidan Crockett sharing her story of coming out as a trans woman later in life. I'm Lee Wade, and thank you for listening to Translucent.
Translucent is supported by the Ruby Girls Foundation and Square One Salon and Spa, and is produced at the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices at WISO. Up next, in this week's One Small Step, P.R. Frank of Dayton and Mary McKnight of Trotwood met at the Huber Heights branch of the Dayton Metro Library and talked about their own faith journeys, including what it's like to feel like an outsider in a community that's supposed to feel like home.
I've always gone to church. I've always believed in God. Grew up Catholic. Then my wife and I decided about 4 or 5 years into our marriage that we weren't growing in our faith. But, you know, my wife and I met in the church and we were in youth group together. Right. You know, and so why would we leave that whole family and decide we aren't growing in our faith? So we explored lots of different churches, and ultimately it led us on this journey of church hopping, because what you see is challenges among the people that come to a church for what beliefs they're going to take on or what beliefs are harder for them to take on. And then you have the person leading from the pulpit, and then there's judgment calls about, you know, us as a family that have made us just kind of like have to leave some churches, you know? And after about the fifth time doing that and getting burned, and sometimes because I get so involved, when it comes down to do we need to leave this church, and then we do, it's heartbreaking. It's leaving another family.
Yeah.
So after about the fifth time, I was like, I ain't going back. I'm just like, forget it. You know, forget about religion. But then it becomes really important to me, and I really miss it. I miss cultivating my faith and listening to people's perspective on the Bible, discussing it, arguing it, or whatever, trying to find some piece of that to take to grow in my faith. And I have gone to church with Trumpsters, right? But, you know, it's a challenge to me because we have this other shared belief in God. We have this other shared belief in the magic and the mystery of Jesus and faith. But at the same time, we're divided on this man who's in leadership that doesn't represent any of that to me, but somehow they stand behind it.
That makes me sad because you can't find comfort, because I think that our faith can be very comforting.
Yeah.
I was raised... You know, my mom, it was important to her that we have a foundation. And so we went to a Presbyterian church. And then when we moved, we went to the Methodist church. And I got very involved in that in high school and taught Sunday school. And then I became a Mormon.
Oh.
And,
That's what you are now? You consider yourself
a Mormon now? Okay. I don't. I lived a very secular life, and deliberately so. And... which doesn't mean that I don't have some sort of faith. And I don't have church or religion as a guiding factor, but I think morally and ethically, it's certainly based on Judeo-Christian foundations and, you know, I think that Jesus is pretty righteous. But somehow we, as humans, we love to judge. Mm-hmm. And so people are using that. They're using their religion to support their judgment or to justify their judgment of others that they have considered to be other and to be wrong.
Yep.
But especially now, I feel the need for something. It's kind of like I want to reclaim the word Christianity for me, because that's basically what my beliefs are.
Right.
Like, I'm not a joiner. But I also think, you know, maybe you need to find a church. But I'm not, you know, I'm also not going to go church hopping.
Yeah, it's tough. It's tough.
You know.
Yeah.
And my husband is an atheist.
So he wouldn't go with you if you did?
Oh, gosh, no. Yeah. No.
And so the not fitting in part, if we want to circle back to that, is that, like, I'm always feeling like an outsider. And the more I don't go, I am an outsider.
Right. And that's the one thing that should be bringing us together. I really feel this is our love for God.
That was Mary McKnight and P.R. Frank. One Small Step with WISO is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and presented by the Charles F. Kettering Foundation. putting a wrap on this week's edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. This series is available as a podcast wherever you download and subscribe to your podcasts. Please check it out. I'm Jerry Kenny. We'll have more highlights and conversations for you next weekend. Please join us then.